This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. There's that saying, there's too much month left at the end of the paycheck. Where's all that money going? Well, there's the rising cost of living, and then there are people who are being squeezed by the fees. Money that you earned through hard work is spent on just turning that paycheck into cash money. It's virtually a tax for being poor, and who benefits? Well, just take a look around you. Look up and down the street, and what do you see? Payday lenders, pawn shops, check cashing stores. You're going to see more of them in the lower income neighborhoods. So is the solution just tell these folks, hey, open a bank account? That's not so easy. I went to a payday lender and I asked some folks last night about their banking choices. I spoke with Molly and Xavier.
I was raised by my grandma, and I really don't save money, because when you save money, you leave money behind, it creates problems, you know. And second of all, I try and just earn my money, pay my bills. It's not necessary that I have it in the bank, to be honest with you.
Do you have a bank account somewhere?
Yeah, I do.
But you do this also?
Yeah. I just opened a bank account recently, but I'll probably end up closing it because I don't really use it much. It's more convenient. Everyone's like a bank, you know.
So it's the same difference?
Yeah, and then it's cheaper. You don't have to watch the bank. Yeah, because it's pretty straightforward. You pay $7.99 a month, and you get that card unlimited card use. And the bank always sneaks something up on you. That's why I left Wells Fargo at first. So
that was Molly and Xavier. They, like so many others, are deciding to use the street-level financial services because it works for them, and they're happy with the products that they're receiving. So what's going on here? What does this mean for our collective economy? Why are big banks not delivering for the common folk anymore? What's your experience? We want to hear you. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Lisa Servant. She's the author of The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. She's also professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania. Joe Valenti is with us. He's the director of consumer finance at the Center for American Progress. And with us in the studio, Angela Martinez Alvarado. She's a senior management analyst at the Family Assistance Division for the San Antonio Department of Human Services. And welcome to The Source, all y'all. It's great to have you. So, Lisa, let me tell you about your book. It reminds me of, it was like as if Nickel and Dimed and Bartlett and Steele's America, What Went Wrong, Had a Baby. It was like the best of those two books.
Thank you.
So you went undercover and you saw firsthand what these people go through and what their needs are.
Yeah, I was technically not undercover. I like to say I was embedded, because the people that I worked with knew what I was doing, which ended up being a really good thing, because there were times when I was working at the window of both of the places, the check cashing place and the payday lending place, where even though I was standing there serving customers, I didn't really understand their rationale, and the tellers that I worked with really helped explain it to me. So I was embedded. I did work for a significant amount of time at both places, and it was unbelievably useful in trying to understand why people were using these alternative financial services instead of or in addition to banks.
Joe Valenti at the Center for American Progress, is it heresy or are we being heretics to say that people are happy to use these street-level financial services even though they are paying fees?
Well, I think some people are probably satisfied with the choices they're making. But when you look at the big picture, people who are using alternative financial services are often missing out. They're missing out on the chance to build a credit history that would enable them to get a good deal if they want to buy a house or a car down the road. They're missing out on opportunities for them to be able to save. And they're missing out in the sense that, to the extent folks are relying largely or exclusively on cash, they're putting themselves at risk of crime and really running the risk of losing everything.
Yeah, but you have to wonder if these people, if that's their choice or if they're being excluded from that economy.
I'm not going to give the banks too much credit here because they definitely have led to this situation. Half of the people who are unbanked in this country formerly had bank accounts, and clearly there was something about that relationship that wasn't working out. I think mainstream banks can learn a lot from alternative providers about having flexible hours and locations, having good customer service, and being in communities where people are looking for services, and maybe there may not even be a bank branch.
Angela Martinez Alvarado, you're with the City of San Antonio's Department of Human Services. You operate two financial empowerment centers in the city. You see people coming in when they are overwhelmed. They have all they're trying to figure out, I need a lifeline here, right?
That's correct. We actually had an elderly lady who was not paying her two payday loans, and she didn't tell her family. And it came to the point where she wasn't on medication anymore because all her money was going to pay these two payday lenders. It got to the point where they were knocking down her door, pushing her door open and making their way in her home. When she came to us and said, I am scared for my life. I don't know how to get out. And when we see these type of stories, we come in and we sit them down and talk to them and let them know that the law is on their side and how we can help them move forward, that there is light at the end of these terrible stories.
Not a typical story, though. What's the most typical type of thing that you see?
That is not a typical story. While we do hear them quite a bit, mostly our clients come in overwhelmed, stacked with bills, and just trying to make it from day to day. And these payday lending allow them to access money quickly for some of the emergencies that they see. They're not prepared. They don't have savings. So these payday lenders are easily accessible and readily available morning, noon, and night, where banks don't always have the hours or the availability to these clients that we see.
60% of Americans lack the cash savings to deal with a $500 emergency, so they turn to places we see, the payday lenders. It's easy to fill out the form, and you get the money. And Lisa, though, how aware are people of the financial obligation?
I think people are really aware of it. You know, one of the things that alternative financial services actually do better than banks, I think, in addition to the things that Joe mentioned about, say, service and hours, is transparency. I am not at all an advocate for payday lenders and check cashers, but what I've tried to do is to shift the focus or include a focus on consumer situations. And I think the situation of this elderly woman who had two payday loans is instructive here. So, you know, what often happens is that we get angry at the terms and the fact that people are rolling over these loans, accumulating more fees, which is certainly not the way the product was designed. But what's also true is that if we wiped every payday lender off the map tomorrow, we would still have people who are in these urgent situations, the people who cannot come up with $500. And so I think we need to look at the fact that banks are, A, increasingly serving only the wealthy, and B, that the situation of the American worker has really deteriorated because we have declining wages since the 1970s, an increase in income volatility, which has doubled over the last 30 years, and a much more threadbare social welfare safety net, so that when people do have a shock, whether it's a car repair that needs to be done or a medical emergency, they simply don't have the cash. And some of them would prefer to have this expensive credit rather than no credit at all. But I think that's the crux of the issue is, how can we improve the situation of American workers so that financial health can be a reality for everyone? And is expensive credit better than no credit at all? Those are two, I think, of the most critical questions.
We're going to take a quick break. The number to call in, we want to hear your story, 210-614-8980, the Unbanking of America on The Source. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Maybe you've driven past some of these check cashing places, payday lending places, and you wonder who uses those places. And then other folks go past the big banks around here, and they wonder who uses those places. We're seeing two Americas dependent on two different financial systems, but both of them are dealing with the same problems. You know, where both of them are being hit with fees. We use the word predator a lot. We throw that around a lot when we talk about payday lenders. But if you bounce a check, what are you going to pay? You're going to pay a lot. And then sometimes that adds up quickly and you can find yourself behind the eight ball. So who actually is the predator and who is being preyed upon? It depends upon where you sit. So that's what we're talking about today here on The Source. Number to call in is 210-614-8980. Lisa Servan, she's written the book, The Unbanking of America. Talk about the word predatory. Lisa, is it appropriate?
You know, I think you've made a really good point in saying that we need to look at banks in the same sentence. When I talk about payday loans, many states don't have them. And so I gave a talk this week in Philadelphia, for example, and Pennsylvania does not have payday loans. And when I mention the APR, which can be from 300 to 6%, you know, there's this huge gasp in the room, rightly so. And yet an overdraft is another kind of short-term loan. You don't have the money in your account. The bank essentially lends you money, and it charges you oftentimes between $27 and $35 for that one overdraft, even if it was a $4 cup of Starbucks coffee. Well, the APR on that loan is 5,000%, right? So, you know, in the last 30 years, banks have really shifted their business model from relying on making money from interest to making money on fees. Banks made $32.5 billion in overdraft fees in 2015 and have really used the checking account as kind of a gold mine to make fees from debit cards, from ATMs, from bank cards. And so I think while we look carefully at payday lenders, we also need to look side by side at what banks are doing. And I would agree, yes, that banks are just as guilty of gouging customers and doing often unethical and often illegal practices, as we've seen in the last year with the Wells Fargo case and other cases.
Yeah, we'll get into Wells Fargo in just a little bit. But, you know, then I can hear bankers out there saying right now, we offer these services, and there's free checking. You know, if you qualify, you can have free checking. But to qualify, what sort of situation do you need to be in, Joe Valenti?
So typically, if you want free checking, you need to have some type of regular income. It could be from a job, it can be from benefits, and sign up for direct deposit. And in those cases, if you're above a certain threshold, you can get a free account. A lot of banks are now also offering, whether it's what's known as a checkless checking account or a prepaid card, that will have a low flat monthly fee, usually $5 or $10, to handle your financial services. And most importantly, these prepaid cards and these checkless checking accounts don't allow overdraft. Overdraft's a huge problem. The Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has been an agency that's been around for the past 5 years looking out for consumers, recently sued a bank over forcing people into accepting overdraft on their accounts. The CEO of that bank called his boat the overdraft. That's how
unbelievable.
How lucrative these practices have been. So I think people are crying out for an account that means what it says it means, that doesn't let you overdraw. An overdraft is a relatively recent phenomenon, and banks decided to make something a profit center that used to just be a way for higher income folks to avoid embarrassment if their check was declined in a department store, let's say.
Okay, and so there are good banks and you know, especially local banks, but I'm wondering about things like Wells Fargo and Bank of America and some of these people that they seem to be the ones who that do this a lot. What did Wells Fargo do? Lisa, talk about that.
Wells Fargo was opening up accounts for people who did not want those accounts, and also signing them up for other products. And so, what happened once the investigation took place was that it was found that employees whose job it was to open accounts were given unmeetable sales goals and felt like their performance reviews and their very employment was dependent on opening these accounts. And so there were just, you know, a huge, huge number of these opened illegally.
Let's go to the phone lines. The number is 210-614-8980. Enrique is on the line. Enrique, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you so much. Going back to I have a statement. I work for the state. I have an account, and I have direct deposit. And like they said, it's like Lisa stated earlier, the companies are pulling. I have a fee that's $27.50. Now it's $35.50. I'm opting out of that, my direct deposit, going to get my check in hand so I can go to one of these loan places to get my money directly to me. I mean, that's, to me, it's heartening that I have to work 80 hours a week just to get, you know, half my paycheck.
So you resent the fact that you have to pay money in order to get access to your own money, Enrique.
Exactly. And then trying to go use a financial system to get your credit built you still have to give them money because they have these secure cards, whatnot, and by the time you're still using your money, well, what's the difference? I don't understand that, and I know that I just don't understand. It's disheartening to me.
Enrique, thank you for the call.
The banks are treating us.
Appreciate how that works. So, Lisa, can you react to that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that that this speaks to, now the gentleman, Enrique, has a regular job that comes with a stable paycheck. He may not be able to maintain his monthly balance. A lot of free checking is, and free checking actually has declined a lot, the availability of these accounts over the last 10 years. The other thing, though, this speaks to, and it's not exactly Enrique's case, but when you have, if your free account is dependent on direct deposit and you work an hourly job where your hours can change radically from week to week or month to month, it's very hard to work with those constraints. So I think he's exactly right that many, many accounts. Now, Enrique may be able to do some research and find a better account. He may be able to find a credit union. But it's not happening automatically. Consumers these days have to do a lot of work to find an account that will actually meet their needs.
And it's very difficult to change banks. I know, Lisa, at your website, lisaservon.com, you have a document there that helps explains people how to fire their bank and move to a new one.
Yeah, and I think another thing that I recommend that's worth saying is for people to be able to have a portable financial identity that makes it much easier for them to move from one account to another.
I would agree with Lisa on that point. It doesn't really matter who you are. You know, if you have a stable bank account and you've got direct deposit coming in, maybe you have different kinds of automated payments going out, it's really difficult to turn that around and move your money to another bank. I've long advocated for having an easy mechanism for you to fire your bank and carry everything over to a new bank or credit union so that you can actually just say no and move your money seamlessly. And I think that would make our financial system a lot more competitive.
Let me ask Angela Martinez Alvarado over with the San Antonio Department of Human Services. They do the Family Assistance Division. They have two financial empowerment centers. What kind of services do you provide?
Absolutely. So our services are free. We don't have any income-based services. Anyone is free to come to use us. We offer free credit reports. So we will pull somebody's credit report, sit down and review them with them, help them understand what their score means. And if there's issues on the credit report that need resolving, we will help them do that. We initially do that for them up front, but our name is Financial Empowerment Center. So we empower these individuals by showing them how to do that themselves. In addition, we will sit with them and search for banks or credit unions that fit their needs that are in their community, and we help research those for them. In addition, we also help them work towards establishing some sort of savings. Our goal is 2% of their annual income.
Now, why is it in the community's best interest to try to help people who are unbanked and who are people who are paying fees?
Well, one, we would like the money to come back into the city of San Antonio, and those who have access to their money are able to choose where they'd like to spend it. But when they are tied up with different fees in accessing their money, that's less money. Over a lifetime, that's about $40,000 an individual spends that could be easily used into their community.
If you don't have a bank account, ultimately, you may end up paying twice because you'll pay first to cash a check, and that can be, depending on where you live, the type of check, maybe 3 to 5% of the value that's coming right off the top that you're losing. And then you're paying again, typically, for money orders and prepaid cards and other kinds of services. So it's in city's best interest to help their residents give themselves a raise effectively and find ways that they can spend or save more money in the local economy.
Agreed.
I couldn't agree more, but I would say that, you know, oftentimes the reason that people use a check casher is that they can't afford to wait for their money. So that the time, probably all of us on the phone here can have the time. I just deposited a check at my bank this morning, and I don't need that money right away. I can wait the 4 or 5 days it takes to clear. And so I think we all agree that people deserve safe, affordable financial services. Where I may disagree is that I think that banks are increasingly not providing those and not providing a clear path to people's financial health. so consumers are often making rational decisions when they choose to use alternative financial services, and those, and at the same time, those decisions are expensive.
So, Lisa, forgive me for being cynical, but I wonder when big banks are making half of their profits from overdraft fees, and whether or not they are being as expeditious as possible when it comes to moving that money around. It seemed like there's a motive. If you're making so much money off of overdraft fees, and people are, they cash a check, and then we know we had these automatic withdrawals happening all the time. How do we know that this money is going into my account as soon as it possibly can, or are they just sort of horsing around?
Well, the technology exists. This is, you know, the technology that banks use to kind of take that check and cash it is outdated, decades-old technology. So they do have the technology to make this happen much faster does exist. And one of my favorite innovators is actually a company in San Francisco called Ripple that's working on something that they call an Internet of Value. That's kind of like the Internet of Information, where we can all send emails and reports both for free and immediately. And they're trying to do something that's called taking the friction out of the system, so that when you put that check in your bank or you send a bunch of money to a relative in Guatemala or Mexico, it gets there immediately. The way that it happens now is that that money makes several stops between my Western Union here in New York City and that bank in Guatemala or Mexico. And every time it stops, it takes a little time. Someone takes their cut. There's room for error. And so banks have the opportunity to use that technology to get our checks cleared for free. And that right there, that one technological change, could open up the banking system for many, many people who simply can't afford to wait to get their check cashed.
And what's holding that innovation back?
It's hard to say. I mean, there's a little bit that has to do with regulation. One of the things that's happening right now is that there's an awful lot of fintech, financial technology, that's creating new products, and our regulatory system is pretty complicated, and many would say not that efficient, and doesn't quite know how to deal with these new kinds of products and technologies. So that's part of the problem, and there are answers to that as well. The UK is created something called a regulatory sandbox, where they can fast track these kinds of regulations. And other is that we haven't seen the desire from banks to change it. The customers that banks really want, those of us that have money and are not overdrafting, don't care as much about having their checks sit there for 3 or 4 days. Or we have stable jobs with direct deposit that give us our money immediately. But for people who are not paid like that, they're not getting that benefit of the bank.
And Joe, real quick.
Yeah, there are a couple of thorny pieces here. One is that if you make payments faster, which is extremely important, you also have to make sure that payments can be recalled in the event that, you know, money is taken out of your account fraudulently. You need to be able to get it back. So there's this challenge with faster payments to make sure that people still have recourse. The other challenge is we don't want to throw out the good regulations with the bad. We've got 15 states now. South Dakota has joined other states. 90 million people live in states where payday loans are effectively banned.
Texas is not one of them for sure. We're going to talk about that when we come back. The Unbanking of America on The Source. We're going to get to these calls. Jerry, Abraham, Carl, stay tuned. We're going to get you on the air. This is The Source. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the Unbanking of America, how the new middle class survives. That's the title of the book by Lisa Servon. Also with us is Joe Valenti, the Director of Consumer Finance at the Center for American Progress, and Angela Martinez Alvarado. She is a Senior Management Analyst at the Family Assistance Division for San Antonio's Human Services, Department of Human Services. They operate two financial empowerment centers here in the city. We're talking about how folks are using these street-level financial services, turning away from the big banks, why that is, and is it costing them, or are they really being preyed upon? What are their services like? What are their experiences like? And we invite you into the conversation, 210-614-8980, like Jerry's called in. And Jerry, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Every time I hear a story about fiscal services, we always use the term banks as a collective for all the organizations out there. But sometimes I heard, like moments ago, credit union. And I just would like to know, what are the differences? Do they operate in the same fashion, or do they overdraft us? You know what I'm trying to say. like, what are the differences, which one's better, those kinds of things.
Okay, Jerry, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. And San Antonio's got some great credit unions here locally. Lisa Servon, you bank at USAA. Is that a credit union?
No, it's a bank. It's a military bank, actually, and you have to have had some military in your family in order to access it. I until recently, until I moved universities, I did not have a credit union near me that was easily accessible. But the caller brings up a very important point. On the whole, people who use credit unions pay much lower fees annually than people who use banks. They still differ from one to another, just as you can't say that all big banks are bad and all small banks are good. You have to do a little bit of research. But credit unions are cooperatives. They're owned by members, as opposed to banks, which are for-profit corporations that are designed to maximize profit. So checking out a credit union is generally a good direction to go, and there are some links on that website button that you mentioned a minute ago, David, how to leave your bank on my website, lisaservon.com, that will help you compare credit unions and also perhaps find a bank that better suits your needs than the one you're in now.
So the impression is that credit unions, they're great, but maybe not as nimble or as effective, efficient as banks. I mean, is that fair, Lisa?
Not necessarily. I mean, they will give you a loan. Many of them, too, I guess this is one important point to tell to readers, listeners, is that many credit unions and also smaller banks are now accessing larger ATM networks. They're enabling people to get reimbursed for ATM fees. So you shouldn't necessarily pick your financial services company based on how many ATMs it has, because that is that could be misleading. You may be able to use ATMs near you or get your fees reimbursed depending on the credit union or bank you choose.
Okay, so let's go back to the USAA thing. So here you are, a banking expert. You know banks, you know how they work, and you don't like paying fees. So, and here you are at USAA, a local institution that we're proud of here in San Antonio. And is this an endorsement?
You know, I'm not endorsing anyone, because I think when you choose a financial institution, we all have different needs depending on our assets, how much money we make, whether our income stream is regular or not. For me, I chose USAA because it has very good customer service. It provides all of the financial services I need, and I feel like I'm dealt with very well, and that the fees are very transparent.
Okay, another caller, Abraham. And Abraham, hi, welcome to The Source, and you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for the conversation. It's a great conversation. Just a quick add-on onto the website of how to change my bank. One thing I would like to, maybe she could add, Lisa, there, is if a banker, if you go into a bank and a banker is doing 70% of the talking, I think you should get up and go. That should be something that people should know. But one thing I was going to say is that I used to work in a bank, and I used to work in one of the major banks, and in one of the low-income communities. And, you know, genuinely, you always try to help them out and try to help them figure out all the financial tools that you have available for them. But there's something about the disciplinary that they don't have enough discipline to save money. Right now is the time where people get income tax. And within the month, it's gone. And you try to show them, you try to tell them why, and you go to these community events and you try to educate them on the importance of saving. And, you know, I think the statistic is 65% of people can't come up with $500, you know, that sort of thing. And you try really hard. So my question is how much does it have to do with the mindset, the psyche, I guess you could say, of what the new generation of people, when it comes to money, what they're learning and how they're having to understand, I guess, the new finance on financial budgeting is my question, I guess. That makes sense.
Okay, a lot of questions there, Abraham, and thank you for bringing them up. We'll try and get through them. So, Joe Valenti, have you noticed over at the Consumer Finance Department at the Center for American Progress how different generations, maybe millennials, are dealing with their banking institutions?
So it's true that young people have been looking at debit cards more as opposed to credit cards. They are increasingly trying to watch their money. They either struggle themselves with the Great Recession or they watch their parents struggle with it. But I think it really speaks to some of the broader economic challenges. If you look at the past 30 years, incomes in this country for most middle-class folk have been pretty stagnant, and costs have been going up, and people are increasingly squeezed. It's more of a an economy where you've got Walmart and Neiman Marcus and not a lot in the middle. It's true for retail. It's true across all different sectors of our economy.
And the caller, Abraham, mentioned this is tax time. And here in San Antonio, we're very have this program of VITA. And can you talk about that, Angela Martinez Alvarado, about what VITA is and why people should be looking at that?
Sure. San Antonio is actually one of the leading model cities that allows people to access filing their taxes for free. If you make $60,000 or less, the city of San Antonio has multiple locations throughout to help people get their taxes done for free. We also do encourage these clients to get with one of our financial counselors. And as the caller Abraham mentioned, it isn't about sitting down and educating a client on a 30-minute conversation. These are detailed, complex issues on why people are spending their money as soon as they get it, or opting in for those RAL, those rapid anticipation loans. And we're seeing clients not understand that early access to their money is also detrimental because they are paying hundreds of dollars to access that money easily. And sometimes those fees are in fine print and aren't always communicated to these people. And so VITA is essential for the city of San Antonio, as most of our residents. The average income is $21,000. So this is a free service for everyone, and we encourage anyone to come to one of our VITA sites and allow us to help them get access to their money and encourage them to save it for future use.
So we see this every tax time. You know, they have the person standing on the street corner dressed as the Statue of Liberty, holding a big sign out saying, come over here and get your taxes done, and we will give you the money right away. But what they're really doing is they're giving you a loan.
Exactly.
They come in, they do your taxes, they'll charge you to do your taxes, and then they'll charge you for the loan, a high interest rate for that loan. And so you may walk out that door with what you think is a big fat check, but that check could have been a lot bigger if you'd just gone down to the street to the Goodwill, where the city of San Antonio has set up a VITA desk, and they will walk you through it. And you may have to wait 2 or 3 days for that check to come in, but it will be much more heavier.
Absolutely. Back in the day, I've actually sat down and had my taxes done with a for-profit agency, and they run so quickly through the terms that you don't realize if you wait a week, you can have that check mailed to you or electronically deposited without paying extra fees. But sometimes we don't ask the questions if you don't know what to ask or what to look for. They run so quickly through those scenarios that they kind of push for, wouldn't you want $2,000 in your hands right now? And for someone who doesn't have $2,000, it sounds really great. And like they say, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is.
Right. And so this is the City of San Antonio program. So Lisa Servon, this is something that the city is behind because they want to get as much cash they can into the local liquid economy.
Yeah, I think that the work that the VITA sites are doing and the Offices of Financial Empowerment are critical. The caller kind of mentioned, you know, is it just this generation that doesn't know how to save? I think there's some of that, but I don't think you can paint it with too broad a brush. You know, when you, as Joe mentioned, when you're looking at situations where wages have declined so much, there is very little ability to save, and we also don't have very good financial education. These offices of financial empowerment, which exist in other cities as well, are doing a good job, but in many cases, you know, they're catching people when they're already in a situation of so much debt and so much trouble. And I think really having good financial education in our schools, starting at a very young age, would really help people understand better the choices that they're making. We have some financial education in some state schools, but it's clearly not enough.
So the prepaid credit cards, that's big. 25% of Americans have used them at least once, but that number goes up to 33% when you talk about millennials. And we've seen some of these prepaid cards go kind of haywire. I'm talking about the Rush card from Russell Simmons. What happened on that, Lisa?
Well, that was a situation which, first of all, it was one of the worst prepaid cards out there. And this is another lesson about this issue of transparency, which my customers at both the check cashier and the payday lender said that was something that they really felt like they needed, and frankly that they got more in those institutions than at banks. But the fact that we lack a lot of transparency regulation that makes these financial products and services transparent definitely affects prepaid cards. consumers may think that they're all the same. The Rush Card was one of the ones that had the most, the highest fees, and their systems just stopped working. I think it's about a year ago in October, and people could not get their money, not use their cards for a period of several days, and it caused a huge crisis. Having said that, prepaid cards do work for some people. I would say that given the choice of a checking account or a prepaid card, for most people, the checking account is a better option if you can afford it, because prepaid cards do tend to come with pretty high fees.
And a fee per use sometimes for some of these cards, and that's
yes.
$1, $1.25
yeah,
each time.
You're paying to load your card, and then you're paying to
that's crazy.
Use it as well.
All right, so we're going to take another break. We'll come right back. Mary Kay, Joey, we'll take your calls. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the unbanking of America. When you look at our financial systems that we have here, they tend to be penalty-based. If you somehow mess up, you're going to pay the price. That's not the way it is around the world at some other places, but that's the system that we have in the United States. What's your story? How did you get dinged by the banks or by one of these storefront shops you want to hear? Or how did it help? You? How did it save your skin when you got in trouble? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. And Mary is on the line. And hi, Mary. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to hear whoever would like to call in, or the people you have already online, please address the fact that payday loan companies are complicit in the funding of the opioid abuse epidemic that's going on. It's an easy way to snare money quick. You don't think about the repercussions and the actually astronomical interest rates that will fall in right behind it because they can't pay the loan back in its entirety, generally ever. So there's this spiral that happens, especially if it's happening on the secret, and suddenly the other spouse finds out about it. Their bank account is drained. They're in a huge financial hole. It really has funded, I think, in a large way, the opiate and heroin epidemic that's been going on. And I know in certain states they're trying to clamp down on the interest rate and how high it can be. But I don't know this for a fact or how if the law is getting involved and trying to shut some of these places down. But I know from personal experience and my own friend bank and family bank that this is, it's really been the main funder of addiction use.
Okay. All right. Mary, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. Lisa Servon, has that been your observation? You went out and worked in some of these shops?
Right. I can't say for sure. You know, I haven't done the research to verify whether whether there's a complicity there. I can say, although I have to say that I interviewed, in addition to working behind the counter at a payday lender and working on a hotline for people having trouble paying back their payday loans, I did learn about many, many people's experiences. And I would say that addiction was related to indebtedness in a few cases of people I talked about, but I can't talk about the broad terms. One of the things that is happening right now, you know, as you mentioned, I think, these lenders are currently regulated only at the state level, and the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has drafted regulations that would be national for all payday lenders. One of the most important, probably, is that lenders must verify borrowers' ability to pay before giving these loans out. Now, what that will do, when I worked at the payday lender, and pretty much all of these lenders, as the caller said, give you your money immediately, within 5 or 10 minutes, with very little underwriting. So the new rules will force the lenders to actually get more information and verify this ability to pay, which will take a little time. Therefore, people who may have addiction problems won't be able to get that money immediately. And I think the fact that there is some time between application and when the money is handed out will also create the space for lower-cost competitors to create products and services that can compete with payday loans. There's one that I like in Northern California called Oportun. They give small dollar loans similar to payday loans, but they're installment loans, meaning customers have longer to pay them back, and their APRs are closer to 36% than 300 to 600%. So I think more of those kinds of alternatives will come forward and will be competitive when these rules come down.
And, okay, and to Mary's point, it's really important that you have a lender, whether it's a bank or a payday lender, whoever, who occasionally will say no and cut you off. Your best friend might cut you off at some point. Your bartender might cut you off at some point. And that doesn't always happen with some of the payday loans that are out there today, that people just end up seeing the same loan roll over again and again and again. So a woman in St. Louis, Naya Burks, took out a $1,000 loan to help bridge some uncertain income and fell behind on payments. She ended up being sued for $40,000. And that's not an outcome that people typically anticipate when they're walking into one of these loan shops, but it is a possibility.
And to the point of the call, go ahead, Lisa.
I was just going to say that the payday lender where I worked, we did often tell people that they could not have as much as they wanted. They would want a $300 loan. We'd tell them they only qualified for a $50 loan. So I think all of these stories are true. As in any business, there's a spectrum of good actors to bad actors, and that's partly what we need to do, is to make sure that with all kinds of financial services, whether they're banks or check cashers or payday lenders, we separate the good actors from the bad actors.
Right, and I don't think any business model that's going to be lending money to drug addicts is going to be around very long. I mean, that's just not practical. Let's get another caller, Kay. And hi, Kay. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. First of all, I really wanted to tell you that I love your show, and I think it's really great for our community.
Well, thanks.
Go ahead
with your question.
For one reason is, you talk about issues that I think affect the underrepresented people, which are, lower income people, and that often get, aren't represented. But anyway, regarding these lenders, I'm of the age where, I've always been either middle income or low income, but I learned somehow how to manage my money pretty well. So I've never really personally had an issue with this. However, I know several people who have, including my own children, and I didn't understand why they would use these businesses, because I thought that, I modeled behavior that was different. But what I'm seeing is I'm really angry at these lending companies. I really get angry at businesses that I think take advantage of people who are having a hard time or who are lower income. It seems like lower income people have to put a lot more effort and work into just maintaining their life and more money, like has been discussed. I think education in school would be helpful for young people to learn how to manage their money and to understand that getting that money right away immediately, that's what I see happening, if they feel like or they need it immediately, just isn't the way to go. I mean, just in the long run is going to damage. But I really wonder who owns these lending companies. I have no idea who does.
Okay.
But I'm really glad you're talking about it.
So Kay, you had a child that was able to get a payday loan? Is that what I'm understanding from you?
Well,
How old?
Okay. Well, actually, my son, when he was 17 in 2011, he actually opened a bank account with Bank of America. And what I found happening is he wasn't very communicative with me. And here he was overdrafting himself, like, on a pretty consistent basis and being charged these $30 fees. Well, several times I found out about it, and I covered him, and I told him, let me know when this happens so we can take care of it. Well, eventually he stopped telling me, and they ended up closing out his account, and they put him in the check system for a couple years where he couldn't get a bank account. And I don't know now that they're using the lending services. I know my son actually talked about it, but they go to these places where they're cashing their checks for,
Okay, Kay, thanks. You brought up some great points there. I appreciate it. So let me ask you, Joe Valenti, about 17-year-olds. They're able to open up accounts and get payday loans and things?
So it's not uncommon for young people to be opening bank accounts. Usually it would be happening with their parents' permission. But in this case, the thing that I would point out is that under current law, you actually have a choice about whether to allow these overdrafts to happen or not. And when you open up a bank account, you can say no way. The case involving the banker whose boat was called the overdraft, it was a bank that would do everything in its power to make you sign on the dotted line to say, yes, I want to be able to overdraft. If I run out of money, go ahead and charge me every time. People can say no. And then when there's no money in the account, the transaction is just declined. And I think for long-term money management, just saying no to overdraft and not letting it happen in the first place is probably better off for consumers than letting them rack up these fees.
Okay.
This is a very good case for transparency also, because, you know, the disclosure agreements you get from a bank run an average of 44 pages long. And most of the people, if you just interviewed them on the street, would say that they don't know whether they opted in or opted out to overdraft service. So I completely agree with Joe, and I think making that choice much more clear, I think especially a young person, a 17-year-old, might not really know what that means. And so having that education that Angela's group is providing, and also the transparency and making it very clear when someone is signing up, are critical.
Okay, real quickly, Joey has a comment about that. Joey, just real quick, your comment.
I just wanted to say that when I was in college, I got all these overdraft fees, and I didn't understand why. And finally, I understood, like, you can just turn it off. Like, you tell them, I don't want overdraft fees, and I don't want to be overdraft. If my account's zero, it's zero. Don't put my card through anymore. And it was with a national bank, and they turned that off. And even with my credit unions, I have it all set up like that. And like they said, it's just we need advocacy to tell people to go do that because, you know, before that, like, and this was around 2007, the banks were actually ordering your charges so that the cheapest charges would hit first, so that your most expensive charge would hit first. You'd get overdraft, and then they'd have all your smaller overdrafts go through and penalize you $30 per overdraft.
All right, Joey.
They got in trouble for that.
Joey, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. We are out of time. I want to thank all of our guests. We had Angela Martinez Alvarado. She's with the City of San Antonio's Family Assistance Division. They operate family empowerment centers, places to go if you think you're in trouble here. They can help you with the budgeting and figure out what to do with your finances. Joe Valenti, Director of Consumer Finance at the Center for American Progress. Joe, thanks for joining us. And also Lisa Servon. She's got lisaservon.com. Look at her website. Some great information there. Her book is The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. Lisa, it was great having you. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.